download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time to reload this week's news. 312-981-7200. What's the biggest stories, the winners, the losers? Overreported, underreported, which story took you down the rabbit hole, and which story from this week will be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 50, 100, 150, 250, 500 years from this week. There's a lot of options. In studio, their panel tonight, Carol Felsenthal, longtime columnist at Chicago Magazine. Good to see you, Carol. How are you?
Good.
Good. You. And Mick Dumpke with us tonight from ProPublica, Illinois, reporter and longtime journalist here in town. Good to see you, buddy.
You as well, Justin. Thanks.
All right, so let's get into this. The biggest story this week is a tough one for you guys to get the assignment. We booked these in advance, but you guys got a doozy. There's four or five stories that are extremely, extremely heavy.
Like every week.
Like every week. But yeah, but I mean, obviously we're going to talk tonight about the fallout from the school shooting in Florida. We'll talk about Commander Bauer. All these stories are, and any other given week would be the biggest, but there are a lot of stories going on this week, including Illinois politics, Chicago politics, everything in between. I guess I'll start and just say that, you know, I believe the number one story and the biggest story was the school shooting down in Florida. Carol, you agree, but your angle really is about the FBI, which came out today.
Right, and Rick Scott, who is the governor of Florida, I think he's term limited, and I think he's thinking about running for the Senate now. He is calling for the head of the FBI to be fired, and his name is escaping me now, but he's
Christopher
Trump's
Ray,
guy,
Ray,
Christopher
yeah.
Ray, who's no friend of Trump. I found that pretty interesting. But the thing that struck me, and there's been another story since then, but what struck me immediately was this bail bondsman, I think in Mississippi, who had a YouTube channel, and somebody named Nicholas Cruz with the same odd, peculiar spelling of the first name put his name down there and said, I'm going to be a professional school shooter.
He
and the bondsman called the FBI, which visited him the next day, but said they couldn't find that guy and there were no identifying marks. Well, the name was identifying. Somebody said that there were 12 people with that name and the first name spelled that way in the U.S., six of them in Florida. Of course, you wouldn't have known that the shooting was going to happen in Florida, but it seems
it's hard.
Like a missed.
Yeah, and you question, I mean, what would the FBI have been able to do, even if they went and faced this kid up? Maybe you scare him a little bit, but, I mean, there's really no thing legally that you could do to stop him if he hasn't made a crime yet, right?
Right, but there were so many warnings that this guy was giving out. He was a very violent young man, and the people, the students in the school said that if somebody was going to shoot the place up, it was going to be Nicholas Cruz.
And that's terrible. I mean, Mick, this kind of story, and you've covered a lot when it comes to guns, has quickly turned into another rallying cry in this country to do something at the federal level, at least, to deal with shootings, guns, and everything that goes into it. I mean, are you surprised that we're back here as a country?
No, it's a cycle we've unfortunately become all too familiar with. The one potential difference is that you're hearing, you know, some of the leading cries are coming from students at the school saying, you got to do something. I mean, it's children basically saying to the supposed adults in this country, you know, what on earth are you doing? I mean, we need help. You should have done something about this. You let us down. And
they're voters, too. You know, these are 16-year-olds and maybe 18-year-olds.
They are potentially, they're all going to be voters or not, but it's like they're kids. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, the old adage from the mouths of babes. It's just like, so I think that's really touching a lot of people is just the fact that it's not just the usual players engaging in the usual debate. You have people who literally were in the school a couple days ago, you know, with a guy walking around with a rifle, a military grade rifle. And now a couple days later, they're on social media like kids are. And they're saying, you know, like I saw one of them before I came in here, you know, Cruz picked the wrong school to walk into because we're going to fight back. This is going to be a real issue. So I think that's a real interesting, important storyline to follow.
And one of them said something that really struck me. This is a generational thing. Your generation is going to do anything, but our generation is going to. And I found that to be a really poignant comment. On the other hand, you saw Trump's response to it was all about mental illness.
Yeah.
And then so much of the story is this Nicholas Cruz was a mentally ill person who should have been in a hospital, locked
missed,
up,
and
being
law
treated.
Enforcement may have missed
so
the
you're,
science, right.
You know, I think the gun control. One of the interesting things, I mentioned Rick Scott. The last time there was a shoot up in Florida, he said gun control isn't the answer. This time he said everything is on the table.
Well, and, you know, Donald Trump talking about mental illness and we need to do more mental illness. I believe his budget cuts, you know,
right,
potential funding for mental illness as well as the healthcare system generally. So, you know, who is there who isn't somewhat two-faced on this, you know,
yeah,
the
right.
upper levels of politics? I mean, that's the
both parties
truth
all the way
matter.
Across the board. I the question I have, and you've covered this a lot, both of you have, but Mick, I mean, where are we? I mean, because we'll just knee-jerk into responses. I mean, don't get me started on Russian trolls, because it all plays into that as well when we talk about, but the we knee-jerk into bashing the NRA, or we need to, you see everyone on your Facebook or social media talking about, oh, it's the politicians, they won't ban guns. Are we asking the right questions? Are we moving this forward in a way that we can, as a society, all respect where everybody's coming from? Or do we just kind of go back to the old tropes of every time this happens, everyone starts pointing fingers and really everyone is uneducated on the issue?
Well, I don't know if everyone's uneducated on it, but I do think you're right that we go back to the old positions because, I mean, in fairness, we don't know what else to do. These things keep happening. I mean, I'm to the point, I don't know about you guys, where I feel like at some point in my life, either myself or someone I know is going to be involved, you know, caught up in an active shooter situation. You just feel like it can happen anywhere. It's happened in churches. It's happened in movie theaters. It's happened when you're at a concert. It happens when you're at school. So where is there? You know, it happened this week, the different situation, but with the officer, you know, downtown at the Thompson Center in the middle of the day, and I was out to lunch with a friend. You go down the wrong block, you could have been caught up in that. And that's not someone who, you know, it's not the same kind of shooting, but it's part of this epidemic of gun violence. So to answer your question, Justin, I think the first place is just to recognize, in fairness to everybody out there who's just throwing stuff out, we don't know what to say. We don't know what to think because everyone is so yeah. frustrated and dismayed by it. But I do think the details really matter. So gun control, no gun control. Well, between those two poles, those two ends of the spectrum, there's a lot of room to maneuver. So I think the specifics really matter when it comes to public policy. And I think if there are two sides, I actually think there are many sides, but if there are two sides, they both have some legitimate points. Why is it either mental health or access to guns? Why, you know, it's obviously some combination of all these things.
Yeah, right.
There's also the great divide in this country between urban violence and between suburban, rural swaths of this big country, and you're already beginning to hear it. I could count on two hands today the number of times I heard Chicago being run through the mud again, as here's a yeah. city with the strongest gun control laws, and yet we have all these thousands
right,
of
right.
shootings every, and that's a very persuasive argument to people who aren't sitting in a studio in downtown
but,
Chicago.
And I guess that's my point
here.
When I say going back to the old, every time, I mean, this must be fact checking websites gold rush time, because, you know, when it comes to even the idea of Chicago as the biggest or the strongest gun laws in the country, yet what's happening on the street, well, that's just not true.
Right.
That's not true.
Right.
And then you go to the NRA puts so much money in these pockets. Yes, that's true, but that might not be the reason. There's pretty strict gun laws on the books as we speak. I mean, there's a lot in there that both ways it feels like we kind of cherry pick to get our political ideals on the table.
That's absolutely right. I mean, are the current laws being enforced effectively? I mean,
right.
So that's a question. And Carol brought up the whole, you know, there's a whole debate right now about the FBI. So with the tools that are already at our disposal, were they used appropriately? So that's one thing. The second thing is, you're right, Chicago is not an island. So Chicago probably does have among the toughest gun control laws in the country.
But Indiana, right?
Yeah, not Indiana, not Wisconsin, not Michigan. And, you know, I once saw, you know, somebody say, why are there so many guns in Chicago? Because highways. So, you know, if they're going to come everywhere else. So there really does have to be more than just local, hyper-local solutions.
Yeah, we got to figure it out. Hopefully, we've got an hour and a half for this segment, so we'll figure it out by the end. Mick Dumke, Carol Felsenthal, my guests tonight. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. 708 says, I'm a gun owner and a hunter. I've never understood the need for more than one shot. If I miss, so be it. 630 says, every school has a kid identified as the kid that's going to shoot up the school, quote. If it were to happen, what are we supposed to do? Go arrest every kid that is that kid in the school?
There was a month ago, there was quite a strong warning that's coming out now. And the FBI itself is doing we made a mistake. Yeah. We messed up on this.
And it goes to, those are tools that are available. You're right. I mean, the FBI should be making. All right, let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Mick Dumke, Carol Felsenthal in studio as we continue on the biggest stories of the week. I mean, as we just heard, Commander Bauer being shot and killed in the Loop on Tuesday, of course, with the memorial and funeral tomorrow. That is a big story for Chicago. And
their wedding anniversary.
And the wedding anniversary. Just everything about... I mean, it is a story that resonates with Chicago, and the funeral or the procession of bringing the body through the Loop after the shooting. I mean, it was a really, really big thing for the city of Chicago.
Yeah, it's an officer who apparently believed in and was active in community policing. Just had a great personal story, his family stories. Everyone has come to see it, so it's. It's heartbreaking. There's all the shootings here, I think, are heartbreaking, of course. But when you hear somebody like this who's trying to do his job on behalf of the public and something like that happens, it really touches people.
Yeah. And the circumstances.
He jumps in when he didn't have to.
Yeah.
He heard it on his radio and he jumped in. And he's a guy who seems to have had this. As the stories go and as a newspaper columnist, Heidi Stevens' column. Right. I thought that was just a really moving piece of writing. And what she was saying is that this was a balanced guy. And she knew him because one of her children goes to school with his daughter at the South Loop Elementary School. And the teacher's saying, you know, he'd be the first person I'd see standing out waiting to take pick up his daughter. I said during the break that it's kind of a central casting thing. Can't say that I ever heard of the man, but he seems like a really impressive man. And it happened on that cold winter day, and it just tugs at you.
Yeah, and there's been so much made of his character and who he was and what he meant to the community and to his friends. It's particularly, I mean, it adds to the heartbreak.
And he lives in Bridgeport.
That's right. Well, that's one story that obviously we continue to watch. And the other part of it, too, today, which is a strange add to this story, was the suspect, Shamari Legette, was being processed and going through the jail. And Rob had the story, and I had the story earlier, just this, that there was applauding and cheering from prisoners that watched him walk by. I mean, that really, it's a very divisive scene, of course, to see that video on the news or hear that story. That's something that really riles up citizens.
Well, yeah, on the face of it, and for people who haven't seen it, it's out there, but basically when you're a suspect, you're brought the first court appearances, or one of the first court appearances, you go to bond court, where a judge decides the conditions for you under which you're going to be held until the trial process starts. So he was either going into or out of bond court, and as the video shows, there's a small cell packed full of, in this case, men who are also waiting to go before a judge for bond court. And the video captures as he's walking by, there appears to be a few of the men who are locked up waiting to go to bond court. They appear to applaud. And it is very disturbing. As I was saying to you guys off the air, I don't know the circumstance of that video. And I know this isn't a subject where people necessarily want to hear someone saying, let's be fair to inmates. But I just don't know the circumstances that had to come from someone.
Your reporter senses.
I'm a tingling. Reporter. I'm just sort of like I don't know how that security footage came out. I don't know why they were applauding. I don't know if something was said. I don't know what prompted it. It was presented to the public as here's a bunch of criminals who are applauding someone who murdered a cop, and that may have been the case. I'm not saying it wasn't. I'm just saying I don't think we have all the facts.
Well, so the way that I reacted surprised me. I was surprised myself for reacting that way. First thing I thought of is, do they lose their First Amendment rights to? They wasn't like they pulled a knife out or they did something that was they were moving their hands together, and then the punish. One part of the punishment is that they're going to be transferred to other. Is that
That's the thing. That's the thing about this, because this was released presumably by the sheriff's office, and then the sheriff's office is saying we're looking into how we can potentially punish the people who are cheering this on because it's a despicable act. We'll try to let prosecutors know, so perhaps it will affect their sentencing. And I actually had the same thought you did. And to all those out there who are listening, thinking we're cold and heartless, this is nothing to do with the way we feel about Commander Bauer. This is just our sensibilities as reporters. We're always trying to be skeptical about do we have the full story, the full set of facts in front of us? So I thought the same thing. Are they, if I find it horrific, behavior myself, but aren't they allowed to do it? I don't know the answer. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you have all your rights when you're in jail, but still, it seems like you're able to say something if you want.
The other thing that came to my mind is that this is catnip for Fox News or Rush Limbaugh or conservative talk radio, because it is so.
Yeah.
It's cinematic. It's something you could imagine in like a Silence of the Lambs kind of scene.
It has that. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's despicable on its surface, but you're right. There's a lot of ways that could be played, and in this era of fake news and being able to just show one side or manipulate things, you don't know.
Yeah, and when it was first it was described to me before I saw it, I kind of felt nauseous, and I was really upset when it was described to me. And then when I saw it, I just was like, no, wait a second, where did this come from? How did this get out to the newspapers?
Nail it.
And that second and third set of questions kind of came up.
Mick Dumke, Carol Felsenthal, we'll take a quick break here. We'll get tonight's news, and then we'll continue. I mean, we got so many biggest stories. I don't know if we're going to get to the other categories tonight. But next up, Mike Madigan and sexual harassment claims for the Democrat Party of Illinois. This story is snowballing. And even tonight, Mike Madigan, very uncharacteristically in front of the media, doing a mea culpa, essentially doing an apology, if you will, and saying we need to do better. All that happening tonight. We'll have that and other stories coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Yeah. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Mick Dumke, Carol Felsenthal in studio tonight as we're reloading the news. We're still kind of on biggest stories. I mean, it all ties together. Winners, losers, overreported, underreported. We're going to keep going. But before we move on, Gene's got something to say. Gene, you've got something to say about inmates cheering when people come through with police-related crimes.
I do. Unfortunately, or regrettably, I was in Cook County, and first of all, it was the scariest experience of my life, but yes, that happens. They could be in the pod and they're watching a police story, a police, squad gets hit, whatever. It's like a plague. It just overcomes, and they all start clapping. When I was hearing you talking about it, I was saying, don't second guess yourselves. That's exactly what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They're applauding the fact that this guy, shot Officer Bauer.
Now, the one thing I'll say, Gene, and Mick pointed this out too, that, it was a small percentage, and we want to act like every inmate in the place was cheering, hooping, and hollering, but when you look at the tape, it was only three or five guys that were actually doing it. So, I mean, as much as it's being framed in the media that a whole cell or a whole jail or a whole criminal population has cheered this on, it was a small contingency of people.
It was probably in the Bond area, and in that area, you're supposed to shut your mouth and not do anything. So, I mean, that's all on film, and they'll find out who did it.
Yeah.
But again, even that small, it's like if it, you know, it's like the Black Plague just walking down the hall, you know, just and people will applaud and keep applauding.
All right. Thanks, Gene. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
You bet.
All right, there we go. So let's move on as we covered that story, but that's an interesting insight for someone who was actually in the pen. But Mick, we had you had down for the biggest story, which is one that at the beginning of the week you would have gone, well, that is pretty bad, but now has risen by Friday to be one of the biggest stories, and that is the sexual harassment moment. I don't even know what you call it. Sexual, it's not even allegations anymore. The sexual harassment scandal that is happening in Speaker Madigan's office.
That's right. And there was even news on this, I think, as we were coming down here today. Right. I'm you know, was trying to brush up a little bit on the bus and kept seeing more stuff. And for people who have been following this story, a woman who had worked intermittently for Mike Madigan or some of his political affiliates, essentially, over a course of several years, says that she was repeatedly harassed by one of his top political aides, who's the brother of the 13th Ward Alderman, Marty Quinn. And his brother, Kevin Quinn, is a person who was accused of sexual harassment, basically sending repeated text messages to this woman, which she released to the Chicago Tribune, and then, you know, they got all over the place, basically documenting and backing up her account.
And the story here is that the Chicago Tribune reportedly reached out at one, or Madigan got wind that this story was going to come out, and he had the information. The political consultant had, or the person who worked in his office, had not been fired, had not been reprimanded, and except for his brother at one point saying knock it off. And when they got wind that they had gone to the paper, he quickly fired him over the weekend. That's done. Sounds good. But now there's really a question of, well, why wasn't it done before? Was this a cover-up? Are you just doing it because you knew that it was going to be on the front page of the paper? Well, and there was a lot that went into what Mike Madigan knew when he knew it and why it took so long for this employee to be discharged.
One thing, she sent a letter to his house on November 1st.
To Mike Madigan's house,
so that he'd be sure to see it. You're using the phrase knock it off as interesting, because that's what Madigan said in his statement. I think it was a written statement in which he said knock it off isn't good enough anymore. But it's such a change from Mike Madigan. I've been following him for so many years, and I see him as a skinny guy eating the sliced apple for lunch and, you know, cutting it with his special knife. He's like an icicle. He's like a glacier. He doesn't move at all.
Very disciplined.
You know, jumping up and down and saying, sorry. And I think he sees this as really could lead to his downfall. And it's the first time all these years and months of round are going after him and blaming him for everything. And then finally you have something where he's caught up in this Me Too moment.
But is it? Because he's already said he's not. He already said, okay, I'm not going to resign. That everyone's been calling for my resignation from the right and Republicans, and I'm not going to resign for this. We'll figure it out. And he puts out the statement saying, we've got a lot of things to change. I take full responsibility for not getting in further. The issue, I think, at the core of this is when he knew it, why it took 3 months for him to make a decision, since that was all that information was reportedly given to him. He already dispatched a lawyer at one point, I was reading the story, to investigate it, and he met with the woman. She met with the woman.
It's the classic, what did he know and when did he know it? And as with so many of the Me Too scandals, the initial harassment or initial abuse was bad enough, but it's the seeming lack of response to that that has just made this into the real huge issue that it is. I mean, who knows if he's going to end up, this is going to be his downfall or not, but we don't see too many cracks in the armor of Mike Madigan and his political operation. This is a serious crack in the armor. And there's more than this now. Now Kevin Quinn, the accused harasser, now his ex-wife has come out.
He was arrested.
He was arrested for violating an order of protection against his ex-wife. And she says she notified the Madigan operation months ago about you know, that he was a problem. So it's just like,
and they ignored that too.
Okay,
and
let me.
There's also slut shaming, because there's some investigator who's going out trying to dig up dirt on this woman who I think is about 24 years old.
Woman's lawyer put a cease and desist on it. Okay, let me ask you guys. You're both seasoned political veterans, and I'll play devil's advocate. Mike Madigan can say, listen, I run the Democratic Party. I also am the Speaker of the House, and I have big issues in Springfield. My political organization, the 13th Ward, Marty Quinn, the people who work in campaigns, I'm not aware of all the things that are happening at that level. I'm not. I mean, I don't know what Kevin Quinn is doing every given day. I had a letter sent to my house in November. It is February. That's only a three-month difference. We conducted an investigation, and we made the determination that he was in the wrong, and he has been terminated. So do we believe that? I mean,
it's not believable.
It's plausible in the way that you're like, okay, I mean, you know, I guess he's a head guy, but we know Mike Madigan because you've covered Mike Madigan.
Yeah,
he's a little bit closer to the vest than
his reputation, Justin, is for being very controlling and having an incredible grasp of the minutiae of politics and certainly of his own political operation. And so I think a three-month time period is a little bit hard to swallow in this instance. Also, let's just think about what's been happening over that three-month period with all the news. I mean, it's just like people, celebrities, politicians, you know, newscasters, journalists. So many people have been basically caught either harassing, trying to cover up harassment during this time period. And a guy as politically savvy as Mike Madigan has no awareness of it, and oh, we're just slowly conducting an investigation. I just think it's really hard to believe.
It's a confluence of events that is very unfortunate for Mike Madigan. If this had happened a year ago, he'd be okay. But I think now he might not be okay. We're at this moment where I'm a big listener to public radio. You can't listen to public radio for long without them mentioning people on their programs who have been forced to resign for these. It's everywhere, and I think that
the big difference, I mean, it would be like
more indirect.
It's more indirect in the way that Harvey Weinstein,
right?
Of course, you would say, well, should his brother and should the board of directors, the people who are running, he was running Weinstein Company, but whoever would be the president of the board.
Well, the brother was a bad example, right? Because he was also charged.
Sure, but should he be fired for Harvey's? And I think the real thing that comes out here is that Springfield, when we hear about sexual harassment, there's no HR department in political campaigns. There's no way for the woman who was harassed to go forward. I mean, and there's retaliatory thoughts in here that she wanted to work on campaigns and then was blackballed out of the campaign. That's what her lawyer says. I mean, there's a lot in there that goes more to the heart of this being a classic sexual harassment case with Mike Madigan, in the sense that how there was retaliation or cover-up.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we're also just a few months removed from a state senator being accused of sexual harassment or some kind of misconduct, and, you know, it being revealed that the General Assembly didn't have a watchdog in place to handle this kind of thing. And, you know, who runs the General Assembly? Well, there is a Senate president, John Cullerton, but everybody knows that the chief power, the governor himself has said, I don't run the state. The chief power in Springfield is Michael Madigan.
Right.
So, you know, if you, and one thing that was really interesting, Carol, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. In Michael Madigan's statement or his defense about basically that he came out today, basically saying, I'm on top of this, we're going to fix this. One of the things that he came out and said was, I'm a defense against Bruce Rauner. And he threw that out there, kind of like, you really want to get rid of me now? I mean, that was kind of the implication, you know.
Yeah, well, one thing, yeah, I mean, Bruce Rauner is, you know, kind of a Boy Scout kind of guy. I don't know. But we're going to watch and see what State Rep Sarah Feigenhalts, she came out with a statement, and she said slut-shaming and trying to dig up dirt on the victim is the lowest move. And I think in the next couple of days, I'm going to watch and see who else comes out.
It goes right back to the cover-up stuff.
People who would never dreamt of saying anything negative about Matt.
Carol Felsenthal, Mick Dumpke in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We come back. We'll start the winners and losers here on the download, so stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It is a download or reload the news with Mick Dumpke, Carol Felsenthal. Let's get to winners and losers. We've kind of started to jump all around. The biggest stories covered a lot of our winners and a lot of our losers, but one that you have, Mick, that I think would be a good conversation because this shows up in all of our categories. This story shows up in all different categories. Is, and we'll just say the winner you have is Fritz Kagi. Who is Fritz Kagi?
He is running for the Democratic nomination for Cook County Assessor, which is an office I've never heard anyone be particularly excited about when we're talking
Rarely
about
Rarely makes
politics.
The winners and losers.
Exactly. It's just like people just don't really talk about it. It's incredibly important. This is the office that basically evaluates the sets the value, determines the value of property, residential property, commercial property, and then that value is the basis for the property taxes that the owners of the property
so
have
to pay. So this
week,
of course, he is going in the Democratic primary. He is going against Joe Berrios, a longtime Cook County, the head of the Cook County Democrats. An independent study comes out this week, says yes, the Tribune was right. There is a problem, a widespread problem when it comes to property tax assessments where poor people are getting the shaft. Berrios comes out and goes, I know. I'm a reformer. I'm trying to fix this.
Got all my relatives in there. They're all trying to fix it at once.
But the bigger story, and the one that may affect this election in this primary, is that the third candidate in this race didn't make the ballot cut.
Well, she was, ordered removed from the ballot by county election authority. She has the right and says she is going to take that into court. So that story actually isn't
open,
done
yet.
It's possible. I mean, the odds are long for Andrea Rayla, but they're still possible.
But it helps Fritz Kagi because that the idea was Rayla and Kagi were going to split a vote against Joe Berrios. But a 1-1 and a candidate, an incumbent who has this much pressure and stress, it makes it a much more intriguing matchup.
That's what you think. And by the way, Fritz Kagi's campaign is the one that got her tossed, that objected to her ballot petitions and ultimately got her tossed in the ballot.
It definitely can mean a win for him. And you know, one of the things that interests me about Berrios, and I guess it showed, I think it was the first time I ever really did anything on county government because I haven't written that much or reported that much on county government, but I naively called up Tony Preckwinkle and asked whether she, do you remember when Forrest Claypool was trying to become the assessor?
Yeah.
And I just assumed Tony Preckwinkle, reformer. I called her up and I said, so you're going to be supporting Forrest Claypool? And she said, I am not. I'm supporting Joe Berrios. I'm a Democrat. And she's been behind him ever since. And it's an interesting little, turn in the story. Also, Berrios is somebody who worked for Berrios was trying to keep this woman out of the race, too.
And on a Facebook
message. One-on-one thing, I think that Fritz could probably win.
But that's the question. It's amazing.
Well, Berrios was trying to get the objectors to Andrea Rayla's candidacy to withdraw so that she would stay on the ballot. Berrios' camp wants a three-way race. Berrios' camp also didn't want to be seen as knocking a woman off the ballot, going back to our earlier conversation.
Is it conceivable to you that that a big time Democrat with all the support of the whole state, I mean every mainstream Democrat will come out and say Joe Berrios is
Joe
guy.
And Madigan will be
is it conceivable that he gets beat?
He's a lieutenant for Mike Madigan. Yes, it is conceivable. His own daughter got beat a couple of elections ago, despite Joe working for him. I mean, but I wouldn't rule Joe out. The odds are against him. He was definitely a loser for the week, but you even saw he's a master politician at that press conference where the study was announced that seemingly is an indictment of the way his office has been conducting itself in 2010. He basically said, look, I backed the study. I backed the results. The study's going to, so he's going to say, I'm the guy who brought the study in. That's the way
that's
he's
going to
frame
it.
Mick Dumpke, Carol Felsenthal in studio reloading this week's news. We'll come back and we'll continue with the losers and we'll talk about what we heard this week with the budget proposal from Governor Rauner. We're reloading the news. Stay with us. Thank you, Mr. Martyr. It's the Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Carol Felsenthal from Chicago Magazine and Mick Dumpke from ProPublica, Illinois, are in studio reloading this week's news. We are on to the overreported and underreported. Before we get there, though, I cannot believe we've worked in this business for a while, and when there's a budget proposal from the state of Illinois and the governor gets on, that's a big story. And if it were any other week, you'd be like, well, that might be in the biggest story. What's the priorities? Are we heading back to financial disarray in the state of Illinois? We're an hour into this, And it's the first time we're even bringing up that Bruce Rauner gave his budget proposal speech down at the State House this week. The takeaway of the story, Mick, I mean, it sounds like we're heading right back towards nothing's going to get done, another year of no budget in Springfield.
Yeah, I think Governor Rauner's speech included a bunch of talking points and reiterating an agenda that he brought up on the campaign trail 4 years ago. It just sounded like the same thing we've heard again from him. So if you're giving credit, if you're a fan of Governor Rauner, you'd say, well, the guy's sticking to it. He didn't get a lot of his agenda accomplished, so he's bringing it up again. If you're a foe of Governor Rauner, you're saying, you know, this is yesterday's breakfast. I already heard this. It didn't go anywhere. People are against it. Your own party wouldn't back you right. And ultimately flipped sides so they could pass a budget. So it does look like there's going to be a standoff. One other thing I thought was really interesting is that Governor Rauner railed against, of course, taxation, the rate of taxation, and said that he wants to cut the income tax rate here, but his budget proposal includes revenue from the income tax.
Of course it does.
So $3 billion you got to find someplace then.
The other thing about this, and you know, there was a collaborative tone, but we also are savvy in the state of Illinois now that collaborative means here's my idea, take it or leave it, right? They're not coming together and compromising. But the idea of really saying, you know what, it's due time that we take teacher pensions and get it out of the state coffers, the state budget, and let's move it to the districts. This is a big, I mean, to do that and to say that that's going to save millions and millions of dollars, it's going to shrink government, when really all you're doing is passing the buck or kicking the can or whatever you want to call it to another municipality who is going to tax the bejesus out of their constituents.
Yeah, well, I have to admit something here, which is that I haven't been following the budget, and I haven't been following it because I've been following the Democratic primary race for governor so closely and that's something that we haven't talked about. I guess J.B. Pritzker is last week's news, but Daniel Biss and the way he's taking advantage of that, and I feel like Kennedy is getting back into the game because of the mistakes that that Pritzker made in his conversations with Blagojevich. I feel like my focus is on the Democrats. And the budget is just as you say; it's yesterday's breakfast, and it doesn't change.
Is it a win for Rauner that he gets this opportunity to set the agenda in an election year to say these are the things that state of Illinois should be dealing with? If it doesn't get dealt with, then obviously it's not me; it's them.
Well, that's the goal. I mean, he has the bully pulpit. That's what the budget address is supposed to do. It's a statement of your priorities, your agenda. In an election year, it's going to be one of his most watched, most followed speech. And here we have, a couple of political junkies. We were political junkies for a living, essentially. And I didn't listen to it either. I read the coverage of it afterwards. So that tells you kind of where we are. And I agree. It's like there's so many layers of campaign season. But let's not forget, Bruce Rauner has a challenger. We're all assuming, and it's probably true, that he's going to dispense with Jeannie Ives. But I don't think he was anticipating that. He wasn't paying much attention to her for the first part of the campaign. All he was doing was talking about J.B. Pritzker as his presumed opponent in the general election. And then within the last couple of weeks, he's released an ad about Jeannie Ives, and he's trying to get rid of that.
That was a strange ad. But did you see that ad? The ad where they say that she's for Mike Madigan? Because in the Tribune editorial meeting, she was saying something like, well, he just took the words out of context and said that she's for Madigan. And anyone knows that that's not the case.
She gave him a gift in her ad because her ad is so over the top and extreme. So I don't think Rauner has to worry about that. And I think you have, in the Democratic primary, you have three guys who are beating each other into a pulp. And it's going, and they may damage each other so much that they give Rauner a foot to make it in for another term.
I mean, your old buddy Ben Shirovsky has a good piece about, who do you trust to be the progressive candidate on the Democrat side? I mean, they all kind of say that they are. They all want to take that mantle. But I think it's really funny. I saw it on Facebook. Just like, who's going to be the least likely to sell us out. That was funny.
The one thing that Biss has going for him, that Daniel Biss has going for him, is he really is a middle class guy. He doesn't have any family wealth, and he lives on a lives in a modest looking house. He sends his kids to public schools. I think that's kind of a big deal for people because it's.
But he also has a record in Springfield of towing the line and staying close to Mike Madigan.
Absolutely.
And so you're voting for someone who has been part of the establishment, not as many years, of course, but
you're right, and I think that's the question in the Democratic primary: is where are voters going to go? Do they, it's sort of a throw the bums out kind of election cycle. It feels like. On the other hand, we had that in the presidential election. We went with a wealthy guy who had no voters. By we, I mean voters, not necessarily indicting anybody here at this particular conversation. But the electorate went with an inexperienced person, had no experience in public life,
who was
a rich guy. Are they going to do that again? And we've got one of those in the governor's mansion now. Are they going to do that again with J.B. Pritzker? Or are they going to go for someone who, as you're saying, Carol, has more of a middle class background, is a little bit more policy wonkish? But you're right. Has voted for the establishment.
Well, I don't think you guys are surprised, but I mean, I do think that Governor Rauner getting the Tribune endorsement today is a big deal because it did seem that at the editorial board meeting that Jeannie Ives beat him up pretty good. The question was about the ad. That ad, I mean, no matter what anyone thinks, you got to run the campaigns, and she stepped in it in that moment, and she may have lost an endorsement that would have helped her immensely.
Well, let me ask you this. Who did the Tribune endorse in the last presidential election?
Was it Randy Johnson or
Gary Johnson? Gary Johnson. Okay, so what kind of an impact does the endorsement have?
Well, endorsements don't have an impact.
My point, exactly.
Although I want to, this is a little bit off topic, but I was really surprised that the Sun-Times endorsed Dan Lipinski.
Yeah, today,
that's the most interesting congressional race.
That'll be an interesting
really
one. All right, let's
that.
Quickly do overreported and underreported because it will just. I have for overreported. Stormy Daniels. I'm getting sick of Stormy Daniels. The Jennifer and Justin breakup. Okay, we get it. Give him some. And the P.F. Chang graphic mix-up at ABC7. When I saw that first, I'm like, oh, man, lame Gene Greco bit. And I was right. It was. They just mixed it up. So what did you have on the overreported?
I had the signing of Yu Darvish by the Cubs, even though I am a huge Cubs fan, fourth-generation Cubs fan.
You just thought.
We've gotten to the point with sports coverage where there's as much coverage as of signings as there are of the actual season sometimes. And Justin, I know you're a Cubs fan.
Sox fan, but thank you. Thank you for that.
I know you're a Cubs fan, Justin, in your heart, deep in your heart. No, but I mean, listen, even the Sox, we know big free agent signings can be such a bust. So it makes such a big deal. Of course, I'm hopeful and optimistic, but I'm always kind of like, let's just see how it plays out.
And then on the underreported side, you got a great story that no one seems to be picking up on. It's just the Trump cabinet and their willy-nilly spending when it comes to travel and luxury. They are really tone deaf in the way that they're spending a lot of taxpayer money.
Yes, and I believe it was the Washington Post that did a study and found that 40% of Trump's cabinet members have gotten caught wasting taxpayer money. Jeez. And some of it is really over the top. The Veterans Affairs guy who takes his wife on a trip to Europe, and it's really much. They seem to have all
egregious.
The time in the world to sightsee and go to Wimbledon. And then the EPA guy who travels in first class and says it's for security reasons. And what happens is somebody says to the EPA guy, sees him in the airport gate and screams at him, "You're effing up the environment."
Right.
Well, my feeling about it is, unless a person's got a gun or a knife, he should hear that. Because why don't you want to hear the public? So he sits in first class, which is super duper expensive.
Yeah.
And some of these guys have lost their jobs over it. Tom Price, who was a former Health and Human Services guy. He was the one who was taking private jets. And the Treasury Secretary, remember,
on top of Fort Knox.
he wanted a government plane to go on his honeymoon.
Yeah, I was going to say, wasn't there another guy who was taking his wife
they're all
on
doing
trips?
It's a very strange thing. The paper tells me so, and I believe the journalists are telling me, but I'm always very hesitant to be like, this is a Trump problem, because I could just see no one reporting on it happening in the Obama administration or the Bush administration that these guys were taking first class flights and whatever. I just never knew about it.
And in the Obama administration, there was and it was true in George W. Bush's. I didn't go back further, but there was a rule that you had to fly economy. And for the most part, people stuck with that. And in the Trump administration,
they don't care.
Why did they make that mistake? They ruin their reputations and they lose their jobs. Yeah. So sit in economy.
Because they don't care. They don't feel that they're going to be accountable. The only people who are riled up about this are people who dislike Trump anyway and journalists. So they're counting on their base not caring.
But everybody understands when I'm in a plane and I've got to walk through first class and I'm hungry as hell and I want more than a bag of pretzels, I wish I were sitting in first class. Oh, everybody has that experience.
There you go. There's Secretary Pruitt.
There.
Do you have any pretzels, Secretary Pruitt? Great. Mick Dumpke and Carol Felsenthal are reloading this week's news. We come back. Which stories took us down the rabbit hole and which story is going to be remembered? Stay with us. It's the Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Carol Felsenthal, Mick Dumpke with me. We are wrapping up this week's reload. We've got the story that took us down the rabbit hole and then the story that's going to be remembered from this week. Rabbit hole, Carol, we'll start with you. You got Michael Cohen on the list.
Well, because
that story's on my overreported, but you like that. You go down the rabbit hole with this guy?
Well, because he never goes away. Michael
this is
Cohen
the lawyer, Mike,
has
Donald
been,
Trump's lawyer,
has been taking care and protecting Donald Trump for 20 years now. And he showed up again with his $130,000.
That's got to be a bogus story, right?
Well, but he makes a lot of money working for
so
Trump. Trump takes care of him. He writes the check. And so you have the porn star. And then today I just have to mention it, the playmate who Trump also allegedly had an affair with,
story that was sold to the National Enquirer.
Right. And they did it, what do they call it, a catch and kill?
Yeah, catch and kill.
Pecker. Could you imagine? Can you make up a name like that for the guy who runs American media? But so Pecker does his catch and kill where he pays her off and then he kills the story because he's Trump's buddy. But then the playmate story is just an amazing, it's so amazing. He takes this playmate of the year on a tour of Trump Tower. And his triplex apartment there where he lives with Melania, she lives on one floor, he lives on another. Not only separate bedrooms, but separate
different
floors.
Apartments.
And he shows her Melania's bedroom and said she needs her space. And he's taking her, it's amazing.
For you, you've done biographies. You've really spent a life
somebody give me the chance to write a biography of Michael Cohen because he would be the best way into the mind or what's
all
there.
These little nuggets that come out about Trump and the way he lives and his personal life and his private life that we didn't know. It's really interesting.
He's Trump's Roy Cohn, and he will threaten people. He'll say, "I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your family." A man can rape his wife, which isn't true. He had to walk that one back. He's still very much involved.
Michael
Cohen,
our
next Attorney General.
The $130,000 out of my own pocket line. I'm flabbergasted, but maybe you're right. I mean, maybe if you have a relationship that's this long with over this many years, $130,000 is a drop in the bucket, and they do cover each other in that way.
But why would you say it?
Yeah,
in this environment. For so many reasons, why would you say it?
Right, and it makes is it a campaign contribution? He's not the brightest guy. He puts his foot in his mouth all the time.
Yeah, it's an interesting part of the Trump story. All right, Mick, your story was about that's just a fascinating story about disparities when it comes to tickets during snowstorms.
Yeah, WBEZ Elliot Ramos and Greta Johnson did what I thought was a great story about basically. The distribution of tickets for unshoveled sidewalks and for failing to move your car, some of those streets where you have to move your car when there's 2 or 3 inches of snow or whatever. And they found that there is disparity in these tickets. There's a concentration of them on the south side of Chicago. And I think the day before, Mary Wisniewski at the Tribune had written a story about ticketing for bicycling-related offenses.
And they're out of whack as
well. And as you guys know, I've been obsessive through the last several years about writing for disparities in ticketing for marijuana. The point I'm trying to make is it's the same ticketing map. No matter what the tickets are for, it's basically the same map. So we all
more
know that in Chicago,
on the south side of Chicago than anywhere else.
Yeah. And so, you know, with the residential segregation, this amounts to a disparity along racial lines, too. It's just fascinating in snow shoveling offenses, too. I mean, that's what I thought was so interesting.
Mine was the Russian troll story, which is a big one. But I was reading today a story about there is a couple watchdogs in the United States and D.C. that will watch. They've already know who these accounts are, so they follow them on social media. And this week is a perfect example of how this stuff works. They will earlier in the week, it was a lot of hashtag Syria. They're really into trying to push the story in Syria that Russia and the United States were fighting in Syria. And that could still be the case, and there's questions about whether or not they were actually fighting each other, these two countries, two armies. But around, right after Parkland, the day, maybe slowly within a couple hours after, all of the accounts, as a strategic mass change, started doing hashtags to gun control. Gun control debate, FBI. This today it was all FBI corruption, and what the point that they make is they set up. You see the story. They set up the cycle in which these Russians, not even bots, they're real people. But this idea of how they try to divide America by taking these hot. They don't care about these issues. They're not for gun control. They half of them do gun control one day. The next day it's anti-liberal stuff. It's like all they're just trying to rile up a divide between our country, and it's working. And they're using Facebook, social media, Twitter, other places like that to do so. It's fascinating to look at the mechanics of how they start with a link that makes it reputable, so you follow them. Oh, they're quoting a Washington Post story, and then they put out something really like a hot take, and then they start using these hashtags and just start flowing and fire them off. It's a whole thing, man. It's scary.
Well, and, you know, reportedly they're preparing for the 2018 midterm elections, right? So, I mean, we've been talking about all these big, what a big news week it was this week. You guys, in any other week, I just feel like the Russian bot story. I mean,
story of the week. Or you put down what story is going to be remembered this week.
Yeah, all these Russian operators using social media to interfere in the election. You know, and it's like we become so numb to this, feel like. And the story has been slow building, and there's so many complicated elements to it. Now there were indictments that came down, and it's just kind of like...
Even more than that.
13 people.
About that, what I think is interesting, we talk about it. We even use their talking points to act as if they meddled in an election. They're not meddling in an election. They're meddling in America, like throughout everything. There's a school shooting, and they're trying to divide us.
Right.
It has nothing to do with, at a certain point, they just want a civil war, or they want something that is going to divide us so democracy fails. And the hardest part about that, from this seat, I don't know how you stop it. I mean, there are some lawmakers that come out and say, this is the biggest threat we're facing. We're at war, and nobody recognizes it.
Trump's guy, Dan Coats, I forget what his national intelligence.
Security advisor.
Yeah. National intelligence director. That's what he said. And he's a Republican congressman, a Republican senator, former from
some scary
Indiana.
Stuff, yeah.
Right.
But what I'm wondering about is, how do they do the midterm election? Where you have, just in Illinois, there's so many races that I'm following, and you have...
I think it's by the hearts and minds of the issues, that, like, they're doing hashtag gun control, all that kind of stuff to try and get us to divide at the big ticket items. Mm-hmm. What do you got for, which story is going to be remembered? You have on your list generational changes.
I think she had Justin and Jennifer, right? Yeah, that was your big thing?
That's Justin Jennifer. I had to look up, but I think this generational change that we saw after the shooting at the high school in Parkland is I have a feeling that it's got legs. That you have a new generation coming, and these Russians better find something other than Facebook, because the young people I know. know, okay, including my son. They're off of Facebook a long time.
Something tells me they're going to find a spot. Yeah. And mine will be that the White Sox are coming to WGN Radio. Oh. I think in 500 years, they're going to be like, remember that week? Remember when the White Sox came here and then they won the next 25 World Series? That's coming up. That's what I think it is. Mick Dumpke, Carol Felsenthal, we reloaded this week's news. I can't thank you guys enough. It was great to have you here, and thanks for reloading with me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.